Please join me in a serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Please join me in a warm San Clemente welcome for tonight's 40-minute speaker, Larry.
Boy, that feels good. I hope I can live up to it. Larry Alcoholic. I got to ask Paul if he would clue me in when I'm running out of time. Give me a 10 and a 5-minute lead, would you? Because I could screw this up bad. Hi, Bob. I see some friends here, and I had some people come down with me. And thank you for just being my friends and associates. And, it's an honor. I want to say to the new people, too, this is important. I did a GSR service once, and we went to tradition school every month when we went to the GSR meeting. I did it for 2 years. And the guy who taught that school emphasized, our primary purpose is to stay sober and carry the message. He says our primary spiritual aim is to be there and available and carry the message to new people. So that's... I just want you to know that you're important. And I also want you to know that we're all just alike. You know, you can go to a PTA meeting, you can go to a drag race, you can go to any kind of a civil affair, and you won't find the fidgeting. Look around the room. Everybody's got some kind of a weird itch. You know, I mean, look at Bob, for Christ's sake. He's up there, you know, what a mess. You know, nobody has a full deck in this room. If you did, you wouldn't be here on Friday night. Yeah, I sure as hell don't have a full deck. My home group is the South Coast Men's Stag and meets Monday night in a congregational church in Laguna. My sobriety date, I'll be 24 tomorrow. It's 7987. I'm looking at somebody who's also class of 87. And my sponsor's name is Chuck Kelly. I talked to him today. When I first got him, he's the last guy I would have chose. I thought he was an asshole, and I thought that a number of times over the years. He's been my sponsor from the first day. But I'm convinced now that he was the person most right for me, and the only reason that happened was because I stayed out of the way. And a little demographics. My mother was a teenager and pregnant with me, and everybody in my family lived up in Porterville, which is near Sequoia Park in the foothills of the Sierras. She had to leave town because in 1937 it wasn't cute to be a teenager and pregnant. And I found out later, well, I was born in Long Beach because she left Porterville, but I found out later that my father was her second cousin. And then her grandfather and my father's grandfather were brothers, both on the same last name that I have now, Gil. I was adopted by a third brother and raised in the cattle business up in Porterville. And anyway, I was raised to be a redneck, and I have the genealogy. If you masturbate and it's incest, you might be a redneck. Also, I'll briefly cover a part that I'm ashamed of. And it qualifies the fact that I'm not very tightly wrapped. When I was 17, I was going to a psychiatrist. And in his infinite wisdom, he told me that when I got married, some of these... some of this weird thinking I had would go away. Well, I've been married 4 times, and I'm still gay. We'll get that part out of the way. Yeah. I grew up in the cattle business. I grew up with my great-grandfather's brother and sister-in-law on both sides. And I grew up in the cattle business. In this little town of Porterville, I was the richest kid in town. Had all kinds of money. I was to replace the son that had died, and I didn't live up to his standards. And I was reminded of that every day. I was told that, when we got you, we made a mistake. I was told that over and over. And I had absolutely no self-esteem. Now, this is an opinion. My opinion is that when you don't care for yourself and you have no self-esteem, you have all the freedom in the world to get drunk or engage in any kind of behavior you want, because there's nothing to lose. And so that gave me a lot of opportunity that otherwise wouldn't be available. At this age, it doesn't seem so bad, but when I was young, I lived a secret life in a world apart. But I grew up with all this money, and from the outside, most people that I knew thought that I had a gift that they could only dream of. When I was 17, I had a Porsche Speedster. It was gotten to be about 9 months old. It was a 55 model Porsche Speedster. And it burned up. It didn't burn up. It lost the timing gear somewhere between Porterville and Bakersfield. I called my mother. I got a ride into Bakersfield. I called my mother. I said, the car's broke. I need a new car. She says, I'm not going to get you another new car. I got you 3 last year. And I said, well, wait a minute. There's one. They had a summer home over in Pismo area. And I said, well, there's one on the showroom up in San Luis Obispo. I wish you'd look at it and just see another Speedster, bigger one, a hotter one, and 56. And she says, well, I'm not going to get you any new cars, but I will look at it because I'm going to cash in my green stamps. Now, green stamps were something that you got when you bought groceries and stuff, and if you get half a dozen books of them, you take them into the green stamp store and you can get a toaster or some other wonderful things. So she went up and got her toaster, and I got the Porsche. Needless to say, I wasn't very... I lived in a world that was just insane. My father couldn't write, but he was just an extraordinarily wealthy man. I ended up being an heir to 10 square miles of prime rangeland. I had 60 miles of fence on that place. But again, I had no self-esteem. I had no will to live whatever. I always thought the way out is to die. And I had all kinds of wealth. And I ended up getting in control of that ranch. It took a war with some other family members. But at one time, I run 3,000 head of cattle, and it was what you call a gain operation. It wasn't, I didn't own the cattle. I took other people's cattle in. It's winter range. We'd weigh them in and weigh them out, and I get paid for the pounds I produced. And so I did pretty good at that. But when I finally succeeded, I was going to get the hell out of there, which I did. And all this time, I did an awful lot of drinking. Now, this is before drugs were invented. You know? It really was. I remember when drugs come on the scene, you know, they come in with the Beatles. Yeah, I was already up there when that happened, you know? I finally learned about them, and they made a nice addendum to the alcohol, you know, because it just broadened the spectrum for me. But I'm an alcoholic through and through. Alcohol is the one thing that I have no power or ability to control. I went through these various marriages, and the separation from the third marriage, I left the ranch. And I went to come to Southern California. I knew nothing. Absolutely knew nothing. But I come down in this country, originally Los Angeles and then Malibu and Newport and then Laguna. I was about 31 when I started this odyssey. And I'd left my third wife. I already was responsible for two children that I wasn't seeing. I had one child that passed away, and I'd paid for one abortion, had a vasectomy. Now, that's a record for a gay man. And I settled down in Los Angeles and promptly figured out how to squander more money. I got into the jacuzzi business. It was new. And I become the largest manufacturer of it in the nation just before I fell on my face. And I really lost a fortune. But I had enough anesthesia not to worry about it. I ended up, at that time, I married my fourth wife. I was living with her, and we got married. And that didn't last long. But, towards the end of that marriage, I realized I could no longer drink. That the alcohol, I'd gotten to a point to where if I took two drinks, I'd very likely be in a blackout. I had no way of processing that alcohol. I just didn't know. Sometimes I could drink all night and not feel it. Sometimes two drinks would put me in a blackout. And so I went over to Hogue Hospital. And in the emergency room, or in the, without admittance, and talked to a doctor there. And I said, well, I'm alcoholic. And I don't know what to do. He says, well, there's a program upstairs for $20,000. I said, well, I can't afford that. He says, well, you can go over to the county and take a number. So I went over to the county. I took him literally. I went over to the county and took a number and sat there about 3 hours and said, screw this. And I went and got some drugs. I did 10 years of drug maintenance without a drink. And in those 10 years, of course, I'd already lost the bulk of the family fortune, a lot of money, between a combination of things, a jacuzzi business and a mini mall that I bought that was really bad, really dumb acquisition. I didn't go completely broke. I tell people I'm broke now. I don't have a pit to pass in. And it couldn't have happened to a more deserving person, but it's okay. It's actually quite fine, because I'll get to that. But anyway, I did these 10 years of drug maintenance, and in this jacuzzi business, when I fell on my face, I thought, well, I am going to do what I always dreamed of. And I never did pursue the dream, and the dream was being an artist. And I never pursued the dream because I was afraid of the humiliation that could occur. Well, I was so humiliated and humbled for squandering a fortune in a foolish way, I thought, well, I can go out and take my chances at it. I had a few reserves left. And so I took some classes over at Orange Coast College and rented a little space, and I thought I'd be a painter, but I'm so tactile, and I have a history of being a blacksmith coming from a ranch, that these paintings kept turning into sculptures. So I actually started making some income with it, and by the time I ran out of money, I was making enough money to make it as a sculptor. Excuse me. Not well, mind you, but to some extent survive. And this was going along with paralleling with the drug business, but I had moved in with another female. I was still listening to that shrink. I knew I was going to get straightened out sooner or later. And I lived with her long enough that she ultimately got the house. But before that, you know, I was trying to end that relationship, and she wouldn't end it. And I thought, what the hell, I'll just go back to drinking, that'll end it. Well, I did, and it did. And boy, was she angry and hard to get along with, you know? And that all ended. I split up with her. And about the same time, I thought I'd moved to Colorado. I was up in Leadville, of all places. It's 10,200 feet elevation at the City Hall. But I got a drunk driving instead. And, once I started, I couldn't quit. It was back on the alcohol. Because I'm an alcoholic. The drugs were a maintenance. I could avoid drinking by doing drugs every day. And I never got in trouble doing drugs. But once I took a drink, there was no control. All bets were off. And I got this drunk driving in Colorado. I come back to Laguna, and I got on an SB 38 program to solve the drunk driving problem. And hell, I knew I was alcoholic. I didn't have any problem with it. And they required me to go to AA. So I was smoking a little medicinal weed alone, and going to AA, and I had several things happen in the first go around AA. After about a month or so, I decided to really try it. I wasn't going to smoke anymore, so I quit that. But I had an awful time. Now, when I was 16, my mother told me that I was going to go to hell for drinking. I was drunk all the time then. And I was going to go to hell for drinking. And I just really believed her. She said, you go to church, you think you're going to do all right, but you're not. You have no choice. You're going straight to hell. And it's too late. And I thought, for Christ's sakes, if I'm going to hell for drinking, what's going to happen to me about the rest of stuff? You know, drinking was the tip of the iceberg. Like I say, I had a secret life. I just started holding God in contempt, or God as I understood God, in contempt. Well, when I got to AA, we're holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer, and I'm feeling like a hypocrite, so I have to do something. I have to do something to get over this feeling if I'm going to stay. And so I thought, well, you know, it says we have a higher power of our understanding. So I did a painting. And the painting is of a galaxy as I perceive the Milky Way galaxy, which the sun and the solar system exist within. And I put an arrow to a little point on the, towards the outskirt of this thing, and it says, "You are here." Now, light travels 186,000 miles every second. And where the Earth is inside our local galaxy, it's 28,000 years for light traveling this fast to get just from the center of the galaxy out to where we are. And there's still further to go. And it's just overwhelming. It's mind-boggling. You can't comprehend it. It's too grand. And the dictionary's definition of awe is a mingled reverence. Well, I would look at that and contemplate that, and I get this mingled reverence. It's an ideal time to feel humbled and respectful of a power much grander, much greater than myself, in fact, incomprehensibly greater. And that's how I succeeded in overcoming the prejudice I held against God. When I've met people who have the same kind of hostility I had, I try to go through that story with them and assist in searching that direction, to find a way around the contempt we all hold, or we're all inclined to hold. And anyway, I was in and out. I made almost a year. I made 51 weeks and had a little sleepy poo. Then I made 5 months. And then I couldn't put 3 weeks together. And this went on for 2 years. And I learned something. My friend Newell, who I saw today, was a junkie and a good friend. And anyway, he flew in from Colorado one day when I had 5 months. And he was half loaded. He had a snoot full. And we were in the car coming back from Orange County Airport. And he says, "I want to stop and get a pint. You want one?" And I thought about it, and I thought, do I want to live? Oh, to hell with it. I don't give a damn. So I said, yeah, I'll take one. So I went back to drinking because I didn't have enough will to live, to make a life worthwhile. And it was just that abandonment of self, you know. I still was buying into the stuff I grew up with. Anyway, after that time, I couldn't put 3 weeks together. And just about 2 years from the time of the first sobriety date, I spent some time with a guy that wasn't a very good person. He really got messed up. He ran a speed lab, and he had the shakes, and he was pretty messed up. And I had reasons for hanging out with him, and they're nothing I respect. In fact, it's a further embarrassment in my life. But we went over to Santa Ana, and we copped some drugs and blah, blah, and got high. The next day, about 9 in the morning, Newell called. This is July 9th, 1987. My junkie friend from Colorado. And I said, "Oh, Charlie and I did this, and we bought these balloons and blah, 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 and we got all high, and boy, was that fun." He said, "Good Christ almighty, you're 49 years old, and you're buying that in the street in Santa Ana. You're going to die." He said, "Why don't you go back to that meeting on Friday night that you liked?" And he said, "I want to see you alive when I come out there." You know, and while I was sitting, and in the meantime, I was a single parent raising my daughter, who's bipolar, and I had a lot of hell with her, and I had just given her over to care and feeding of the state of California. She was 18, and just unbelievably problems. There's nothing, I couldn't describe that. But giving up trying to make a life for her was part of the surrender in my life. And, you know, I didn't realize how big a surrender that was. But that led to that morning, and when I was told to go back to that meeting, I can remember sitting there with the phone thinking, you know, it's time to get well. I didn't even know I was sick, but I knew it was time to get well. And this wonderful feeling came over. It's like all of a sudden the tension was gone. You know, I'm going back to that meeting. I'm going to do what he said. I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to work at being sober, and I'm going to give myself over to everything I can to have a good life. And that feeling has stayed with me ever since. It's with me today. And that was I was subject to a spiritual intervention. I don't know why it happened, but it happened for me, and it was magic. So I went back to the meeting, and this asshole that I promised to do some work for 2 weeks before, but I went and got drunk instead, I went up to him just humbly, and I said, "Oh, I'm very sorry, and I'm ashamed. Do you still want that done?" You know, and I did it out of humility, not for any other reason. He said, "Yes, would you come over tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes, I will." And I went over. I didn't know it. But in that moment, he became my sponsor. And he's still my sponsor today. Same asshole. He's used to me calling him an asshole, too. He knows it. He's gotten to where he's okay about it. Well, he's been I believe at first I didn't like him, I didn't want him, but I believe that that there's some spiritual force that put him in my life and directed him to me because he, more than anyone else, was right for me. Not for someone else, but for me. And I'm very grateful to him today and thankful. And it's a gift. And you watching the time? Am I a bad boy? Okay. We started through the steps. I was almost a year sober when I got to the fifth step. And he told me today to tell about Cousin Willard. And I can tell you how, and this is to the Nuke people. Now, your sponsors, you want to report them to sponsor school when they do this. But we went through the fifth step, and I talked about my mother. You know, my folks were really old, and they had some ideas that were a little passe. They were born in 1981 and 83. And I was probably 11 years old, and my mother told me about Cousin Willard. And we knew about Cousin Willard. He was a shadow in the family, and he was in a mental hospital. And I always knew, but I never knew why or what the conditions were. And she come in, it was nighttime, I remember, I was in bed, she told me. And I'm telling my sponsor this because it's a really traumatic experience. It's a cathartic moment in my life. And I said, well, she come in and she told me Cousin Willard was in the mental hospital because he masturbated. You know? Well, I believed her. It just scared the hell out of me. And my sponsor got to laughing. He wasn't at all sympathetic. And all the way through the rest of that fifth step, he'd start breaking out laughing. And he's still laughing. And he told me tonight, says, tell about Cousin Willard. So I did. That was his doing. Anyway, I went on in the... how much time do I have? Well, no. How much would I? What time do you want me to go to?
8:25.
You want me to get the hell out? Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm... I went on to do the fifth step. And on the way home, I'll never forget, it says in the big book, it says that when we do that fifth step, it says then, you know, this is step six, we go to a quiet place and we get with ourselves and we contemplate. Have I built mixed mortar without sand? We do the contemplation. Well, when I drove home, I realized what I disclosed in that step was the character of a stranger, somebody I didn't know. When that step, and I did it in longhand. I did 70 pages. That poor bastard had to listen to the whole thing. And but driving home, but he laughed through it. So driving home, I remember thinking, I am almost 50 years old. In fact, I was 50 by then. You know, and I've lived my life for the sake of some fiction. I've lived my entire life acting on behalf of some fiction that I'd created about who I am. And it had nothing to do with the reality. Just nothing. And I remember being bewildered. I wasn't angry. I wasn't upset. I was bewildered is the best word. Because I just couldn't comprehend. I know today, from that moment, that I have no idea who I am. That I'm completely at a loss. And that's okay. It's all right. I'm 73 now. And I don't have the slightest idea who I am. And I'm fine with it. And by that time I began sponsoring people. The first guy I sponsored skinned my sponsor out of $20 and left. And that was a pretty good one. And it happened a couple of times, and all of a sudden I got one guy who was really serious. And I thought, oh Christ, I'm going to have to walk like I talk. You know, and that's a big one. When I sponsor people today, I go through a little thing with them and I say, I want you to realize that you make me responsible for certain levels of behavior that I wouldn't otherwise engage in. Now, first of all, I gotta get over feeling sorry for myself. And depressions had better not last long. And I'm always going to have to take action when I'd rather crawl in bed. And I'm going to have to be and do a lot of things, and it's your fault. And that's true. You know? You guys who are sponsors, you know that. I'm looking at Bobby back there. He sponsors lots of people. And it always results in behavior I don't want to do, and that I'm a hell of a lot better off as a result. You know, I'm a victim of my own success. Now, I don't know how else to put it, but it's a double bind, and it's a wonderful thing that it happens. And anyway, I want to go on and see. I don't want to blow this. I've developed that higher power. I still talk to the universe, and for me, what I always want to say is, whatever genesis of the universe is what I call God. You know, and I don't have a picture, I don't have a knowledge, but I know it's the amalgam of all this wonderful stuff that we live in. And so every night when I go to bed, I stopped getting married. I haven't gotten married for a long time. But every night when I go to bed, I talk with God. And I don't know that I'm being heard, but I know that I'm placing myself in a relationship with God, of which, both of all, I'm subject. First of all, I'm subject to, and beyond that, I'm in association with. I want to go back to the sculpture before I get there. I've been struggling along. This is not a good economic time for artists, and it's been tough. Been really tough, but I've got confirmation on a job that's the biggest I've ever done, and I'm really pleased with it. And I don't have any money yet. I'm waiting for the money, but I've submitted 3 pieces to go to China, this group in China, through a landscape design firm called Lifescapes International, and the Chinese wrote back and they've accepted one of them. But it's the biggest piece I've ever done. It'll be a brass flower water feature. It'll be 11 feet 8 inches tall. And a massive thing. It'll weigh about 800 pounds. And I'm really pleased with it because it's my first taste of being international. And what an honor to it. At least I'm anticipating it. I say I'm anticipating. I got a confirmation that it's happening. I'm just not sure when. But I wanted to say that. It's like I've gotten self-esteem now. I never had it. I until after I entered sobriety, it began to build. And, when I go to bed now, I have a sense of comfort, like I'm all right. I'm no better than anyone, but I'm good enough to be with them, you know? And there's a kind of peace in my life that I used to drink to try to get, you know? But I always figured about the fifth drink, I was just going to go, oh, you know, where that angst, that constant, never relentless, never let up angst, that feeling of, You know, it's like I'm here, but I should be there, and there's no good because over there is where I really want to be. You know, and it's that way every minute of my life, or was, and now I'm pretty free of it. Once in a while I get it, but not often, and I'm pretty free of it. Now I'm going to go back and start talking about having talked with God, or I do it nightly, and I do it, my sponsor told me, I told him, I said, you know, I'm very fortunate. I have a lot of things that are really favorable to me that I just feel gifted to have. And he says, well, you thank God for it. Use a gratitude list every night. So I do that generally. And I always thank God for the people that love me and I can correspond with. And I thank God for, you know, this program. You know, I was talking with Connie on the way down, talking about the history of how Bill and Bob got together, and Henrietta Sieberling. These are names of people that, you know, Sister Ignatia and Dr. Silkworth and Ebby and the Oxford Group and all this wonderful history of this program and the gift that it is to us. I thank God for that. And I thank God for getting to be an artist, because that was a childhood dream. And I didn't believe it was possible. And what a dream. And I thank God for living in a community of so much beauty and in a country with this kind of freedom. I thank God for this country every night. And I'm a Democrat. But what I'm saying is Democrats can be a little patriotic too. And I thank God for the bounty of this earth. And then there was in the Odyssey, which Homer's Odyssey, about Odysseus and his travels after the conquest of Troy. And Odysseus had himself chained to the mast because they were going by the island of Lesbos. And these women played such beautiful music that sailors would go there and they were never heard from again. But the music was so beautiful, they called it the music of the spheres. And I've always liked that concept, the music of the spheres. And I kind of apply it to the entire universe. You know, if you look at these pictures of galaxies, and there's several billion of them that also contain billions of stars each. And I think of that as the music of the spheres. And I thank God every night. I conclude my thank you list with the music of the spheres. And thank you guys for having me.